This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Marie-Thérèse von Paradis was quite a young woman. She was blind from the age, I think it was 2, and her parents brought her to Mesmer after the failure of Orthodox medicine. Some very distinguished doctors, actually, in Vienna, and thereby hangs a tale. She met Mozart in Salzburg, and he later wrote a concerto for her. That's B-flat, K456. And her teachers included Kozeluth and Salieri, both of whom influenced her compositions, which I've heard some of them, and they're really good. She made a European reputation as a concert pianist and a singer, and she was often performing her own work as she toured Europe, Paris, Vienna, London, Berlin. And in 1808, she founded an institute for music education in Vienna, and she died in 1824 at the age of 65, which I think was the age that Byron died, the year that Byron died. Anyway, she has been brought by her parents to Mesmer, and so the first chapter is about that encounter. And then he describes his treatment of her. Often when stroking her thighs, I thought it was... Can you hear this? You can? You can. Often when stroking her thighs, how's that? Often when stroking her thighs, once more, I thought it wise to have my wife as witness. To move the fluids in the proper polar directions, it is necessary to mold the body, to follow its contours as one guides the fluids within by the magnetized hands alone. Since no part of the body can declare itself exempt from this process, these movements could, to the common eye, be misinterpreted. The detail is always more obvious than its guiding principle. So, when treating young girls, especially, it is prudent for my wife, certainly in the beginning, to certify its legitimacy by her presence. With some grand dames, the misinterpretation is undertaken by themselves, leading to embarrassment for all parties. The crisis is, in most cases, intrinsic to the cure. But the forms that this crisis takes have frequently made it necessary to hire strong assistants who will bear the subject away to a protected room where the crisis can exercise itself fully without distracting other patients. On one occasion, I found an assistant taking advantage of this isolation in a way that can be easily imagined, and his departure was followed by rumors that accused me and my assistants of the very transgression for which he had been dismissed. To men of intelligence and insight, such accusations must ring hollow. But life teaches one that these are always in a minority, and one is inevitably led to lower one's opinion of mankind the more one knows of the world and perhaps of oneself. My treatment of Marie-Thérèse, I was determined, would give rise to no such foolishness. I laid her down on the chaise each morning and afternoon, and with my magnetized gestures and strokings, moved the fluid towards head and feet, never urging it impatiently, but sensing as best I could the response of the fluid to my hands as it lay under her skin. It is the insides of the arms and thighs, the flanks and the neck, and to some extent the tiny row of knuckles of the spine that are particularly sensitive to the movement of the fluid. This stroking can, if one is skillful, be effected without too much disturbance of the clothes or of the subject's modesty, if she or he is properly garbed. To concentrate on one's task is most important. I believe that the mind's intention makes itself known to other minds in ways that are mysterious, but which I believe are conducted through the magnetic field that unites the spheres with all living things. Thus, in treating Marie-Thérèse, I often close my eyes to sense these matters more intensely and felt deeply connected to her in this double darkness, hers and mine, which we shared at such moments, a darkness which enabled me to see not only my own treatment, but the two of us from a remote distance as tiny exemplars of the forces which I was bringing to bear on her disturbance. Her eyes were now clear, their restlessness and twitches diminished. They seemed to grow larger as the orbital muscles relaxed, allowing them to take on their natural place among her other features. At times, they were steady and level in their gaze, though that gaze itself harvested nothing. It was somewhat unsettling to have these eyes alight upon me, regard me steadily, at times unblinkingly, while all they saw, as it were, was the sound of my voice. At such times, it was easy to convince myself that the eyes were doing their work, but that the mind behind them had cut off their evidence before it could pass through her internal darkness. How disconcerting that gaze was! As I became used to it, I discovered that its strangeness arose from two matters. First, the eyes did not focus exactly at the proper distance, but seemed to look beyond me. And secondly, they were always a trifle off the mark, left or right, up or down. It is the instinct of all animals, including ourselves, that we find and lock into each other's gaze. I am always amazed at the way our two dogs unerringly meet my eyes to read my intentions. Children, too, do this. And we constantly look and unlook at each other as we talk, making or breaking the connection between us as our gazes slip and meet in accompaniment to our verbal transactions. In the extensive territory between glimpse and stare, how much is communicated? How much is added to our words by the emphasis and expression of the eyes? And how they instruct our silences as we observe each other? No wonder the instinct to observe the other's sight is so deep, thus doubling our sense of ourselves and thus of them. I think of the four partners of the emperor's tennis courts, the ball as sight itself, traveling back and forth between the double partners. So it seems to me when two people meet and immediately begin that game of tennis with their eyes as glances travel slowly or brutally fast, for the impact of a stare is almost like a slap. And how difficult it is to catch the eyes of some. The female sex, of course, make a game of this, as their aim seems to be to look, but not to be caught looking, leading to that game of glances, which is one of the court's main amusements. How much the ladies seem to gather from the briefest glimpse, those quick darts that escape our detection. We feel them alight on us, but when we quickly try to confirm them, we only meet a diverted gaze. For all of this, the stare of authority to the Lord eyes of submission, Marie-Thérèse was excluded. My disquiet under her apparent regard was partly due to the complete absence of expression in her eyes. It was those very eyes, however, that gave me my next direction. For after some weeks of treatment, during which she progressively became calmer, more confident, and less disturbed by her parents' visits, which I now allowed only to reassure the parents, the eyes began to screw themselves into wrinkled pits. For a day or two, I thought this was a relapse. But when she began to cover her eyes with the heels of her hands and avert her face, I realized that the treatment had made a huge advance. The fluids had begun to flow into a preliminary harmony, and I thanked my stars that their influence was so manifest. The light was hurting her eyes. I immediately removed both of us to the large inner room with the mirrors and heavy draperies and continued the treatments in twilight, contriving to have the music played not in the same room, but two rooms away, so that its sound came gently to the ear, coaxing it into attention. In that twilight, I had my great triumph. The pain of the light was itself a kind of blindness, albeit a new blindness. The first indication of any return of her sight was Maria Theresa's ability to discern movement when I passed an object before her eyes, which left her without any notion of the object itself. This frightened her, indeed it would frighten anyone, to perceive a twilight full of unknown shapes and masses at different rates of movement would cause me anxiety. Sometimes these figures in motion were her own self, reflected in the mirrors in each wall, particularly in the largest, over the mantel from which the ormulate clock spoke its quarters, with a tangle of cherubs climbing up its sides to the garlanded urn at its pinnacle. I had the room cleared of occasional tables and furniture, leaving only a few guiding pieces to facilitate her learning of the new space. My servant Hans, usually so reliable, moved one of the pieces to what he considered a more advantageous position without telling me. And after Marie-Thérèse stumbled into it and fell, she began weeping and beating her eyes with the thumb and forefinger side of her fists. I rebuked him excessively, which he received with a dignity that made me ashamed. I then realized the extent of my nervousness with respect to this cure. And pursuing that further, I found myself further ashamed. For it was not only Marie-Thérèse's welfare that concerned me, but my own. A famous patient, I think one could call her that, under the protection of the Empress, who had awarded her father a pension to nourish and protect her talents, whose malady had baffled the leading specialists of our day, one of whom was my former professor. When I shared these thoughts with my wife, she neither confirmed nor denied them, but, as was her habit, said nothing, while wearing her neutral smile, which I often find helpful, but on this occasion did not. Even the few pieces of furniture in the twilight room, Marie-Thérèse began to fall more frequently, though she had fully learned their position. She had always surprised me with her facility of movement after a brief learning period, but now she seemed to have unlearned the room. Her mental state, which had slowly developed into a delightful calm, began to be ruffled, and I watched those changes with concern, but with some understanding. I had developed a habit of talking to her from my red high-back chair with the wings, and my voice alone, I discovered, could induce that calm and confidence which made her body more receptive to the movement of the magnetic fluid. Molding and shaping the fluid with my hands was now a device I kept in reserve. When her condition became acute, I would point my finger at the spot between her eyes, and her shivering and twitches would immediately cease, despite the fact that she could not see my finger. I noticed that when I used my wand, which served as a magnetized extension of my body, arm, and finger, she occasionally followed its movements with her eyes, not directly, but in the mirror. But such movements, such moments, were brief. Though the room was darkened, the dim light began to cause her pain. It was now difficult to examine her eyes in the light. I thus covered her eyes with a triple bandage, which I unwound to the point where she could bear the light, or what there was of it. Often finding myself in a darkness which remained, even when my eyes had become accustomed to it, I was astonished that she would find the light too harsh, even with two turns of the bandage covering her eyes. I took this as evidence that not only the light in the room, but her own inner light was reaching her eyes, and that the fluids were flowing in accordance with the harmonies that would balance her disturbance. Yet the pain of the light frequently caused her to retreat to her own darkness. Nothing more clearly shows the delicacy of the balance of the fluids, or of the necessity of the fluids to be in perfect harmony in each body, so that its health can manifest itself. How fragile and tentative is all life, until it is brought into the grand harmony that joins its individual existence to the ebb and flow of the great forces that move the stars and planets. So as Marie-Thérèse and I made that darkened room a center on which the celestial rays converged invisibly, I felt acutely those powers which can be called upon by anyone whose magnetic gifts, and they vary with each person, as any faculty or endowment does, are developed. I had no doubt now that we would succeed, and I say we advisedly, since I believe that the magnetic doctor is only the agent of forces which the patient mobilizes within, thereby being put in a position to cure him or herself. After the first dawn of light in Marie-Thérèse, events surpassed each other in astonishment. I saw nothing less than the birth of sight itself. And while witnessing that miracle, which I witnessed before in the case of Franzel, much remained mysterious to me about the nature of sight. I began to show Marie-Thérèse various objects in the low light. My aim was not that she name them, for how could she name what she had never seen, but rather that she make a distinction between them, that she recognize that one was not the other. Simple though this may sound, she frequently mistook a snuff box for a watch, a pipe for a Meissen figure. Language indeed became clumsy in our pursuits, for having no names to attach to these objects, she would say, "It's like the last one, or it's like the one you showed me yesterday or the day before. I don't remember." A little family of objects grew on the table, which became to her a forest of confusion. I was sometimes confused myself. I did not press upon her the names of each. To do so, I felt, would be to overtax her memory, since each object is surrounded by 100 names in different languages, to each of which the object itself is indifferent. The object and its name being two different orders of existence connected only by common agreement and memory. My concern was that she learned differences in shape and outline as do children when they grasp and clutch. Indeed, like a child, Marie-Thérèse sometimes applied the object to her mouth, as if her lips were more informative than her eyes. I presented her with two objects at the same time, asking her to describe the difference between them. The difficulties she experienced in this simple task amazed me. Frequently, Marie-Thérèse would close her eyes and rotate the objects in her hand before responding coherently. When I insisted that she keep her eyes open, her hesitation, indeed confusion, became notable. The hesitation between her vision and her language became more pronounced. She did not have a convenient language for shape, though smooth and rough were no difficulty. Knowing the cunning and sensitivity of her fingers as lace maker and pianist, I was confounded by the way the eyes lessened the information from the fingers instead of augmenting it, as I had expected. Since we were making slow progress with shape, I assembled some patches of color and presented them to her. The difficulties persisted. She had no names for red or blue or yellow or green. Red seemed to cause her pain. As for the blue, she tried to put her finger not on, but through it, as if I were holding a piece of sky in my hand. She made no distinction between green and yellow, and when she did perceive a difference, she had no words to express it. At such moments, she lost her maidenly grace, and childlike, made simple noises and gestures. Indeed, where her vision was concerned, she was a child, and I was overwhelmed with the difficulties of bringing this child to maturity in a few weeks or months. It became clear to me that curing the blindness, restoring her sight, was a most complex matter, involving relearning of language, the world, and of space, the new medium in which she now moved in the darkened room so unsurely. I was also made aware of the detrimental effect her rudimentary sight was having on her other senses. Her touch became confused. Her hearing became paradoxical, responding now to the slightest noise, now ignoring what to me seemed unusually loud. Her mouth became an elusive zone. Frequently, when feeding, she would attempt to pass the food through her cheek or chin, much to her frustration. Again and again, when in such difficulty, she would close her eyes, returning to that secure darkness in which she had negotiated 15 years of her life so successfully. This extreme sensitivity of her eyes did not make our task any easier. When showing her an object or a color, she frequently identified the succeeding object as the one previous to it. This happened so persistently that it dawned on me that the image of an object so burned itself into her retina that she still saw it a quarter of time after its withdrawal. It took a long minute for the object, feather, ring, box, to fade from her sight. If I showed her another in less than that interval, she could not see it. Indeed, as the previous image faded and the other I held before her emerged, she must have been even more confused, as now one object was born out of another. She now closed her eyes between objects, watching against her closed lids the after image fade into darkness. While she learned to distinguish objects and colors to some extent, the room itself, bare though it was of furniture, remained strange to her. Its walls seemed to her an immense distance away, as far as the planets, and the piano which stood before the curtained windows she did not perceive beyond a negative pool of darkness. On February 9th, I removed the bandages and presented myself to her in perfect sight, the first being she had seen, if seeing it was, since the onset of her malady at the age of 3. What memories she had of sight or light, I could never elicit. Any attempt to recover that lost paradise only added to her confusion. Certain though I was, such memories would assist her now. Standing before her, no more than a meter away, I slowly moved my hands and arms, fixed on my face a reassuring smile. We both stood face to face in the twilight. Her response was to cover her face and shrink from me as if she had seen something that aroused her disgust. Only when I spoke to her was she reassured. There was a shock to her that my voice issued from the apparition, which she now studied from between her fingers, covering and uncovering her eyes. In my concern, I moved closer to her and gazed solicitously into her eyes, so innocent of the world, speaking reassuringly all the while. To my surprise, she burst into laughter. Not knowing the source of another's laughter is of all things most irritating. I joined in the laughter witlessly. Marie-Thérèse pointed at me, and since the distance between us was so small, and her estimate of distance so insecure, she poked her finger into my face. When I opened my eyes, she had fixed on my nose, and having located this feature, she redoubled her laughter, which in a lady of breeding, which she was no, with no impairment of vision, would be more than rude. Not only did she lay her finger on my nose, but she pushed it from side to side to her further merriment, if not to mine. For giving thought to my nose, a feature we carry without much thought about its nature, I did not find it unusual or an object unworthy of mirth, or worthy of mirth. It may not be sufficiently Grecian for poor Winckelmann to admire, but it has served me well these 40 years and more, and suffice to divide my eyes from each other and from my mouth in unexceptional fashion. With both her hands, she urged me to move my head from side to side while her eyes imperfectly focused on my nose, the movement of which caused her further amusement. Now, relieved as I was to hear her laugh, and pleased as I was to be the source of such a new emotion, I was greatly puzzled. When I removed the bandages the following day, the same scene was repeated, and the following day, until my nose provoked only a mild amusement. The answer was borne home to me only after the deepest reflection. Marie-Thérèse had no idea of the face. Instead, she saw its most prominent feature, complete in itself and unrelated to those around it. The environs of the nose, its setting, were not part of her awareness. Thus isolated nose can indeed be comical, as I found out when testing the idea at several subsequent gatherings. This way of seeing, infantile as it must be, was Marie-Thérèse's first introduction to the visible world, which causes us few surprises, but which to her was full of frights and amusements unknown to the rest of us. She saw another world from mine, from ours. And I was puzzled as to how I might best assist her to see several separate things as they contributed to a familiar configuration, rather than seeing one detail and then another and then another. Thus decomposed, the objects of her sight jostled each other as unfamiliar fragments thrown up in a chaotic sea, in which near and far reversed themselves from glance to glance. This, it seemed to me, as she wandered precariously around the darkened room, her eyes unbandaged, was a dangerous affliction, and I did not wonder that her newborn sight was for her more a terror than a blessing. Patience is the primary virtue in teaching these we wish to succor, and improvements can be so minute, and periods of no improvement stretch without an encouraging sign that we must believe deeply in our end and in our method. Given the improvement so obvious even to the most prejudiced observer, I had full confidence in my method. The case of Franzl and my tour of Germany had indeed confirmed both for myself and others the validity of my ideas and my application of them to individual cases. But this did not prevent me despairing at such sights as Marie-Thérèse, swooning at the sight of her dearest woman friend, indeed she did not really believe it was her friend, or her extreme shyness at meeting or rather seeing visitors whom in her darkened state she would have met with equanimity. She found humankind oddly shaped and without attraction. What grotesques she must have thought us, composed of strange details she saw with great clarity, confused by edges and borders, constantly altered by the fashions of those who visited her. She found the trains of the ladies who visited her absurd, and though she knew in her mind that clothes were fitted and draped on the figure, her eyes led her to believe that the train was part of their persons, and a sliding and unpleasant part to boot. The tall headgear of the ladies, shaped like beehives and draped with veils, she rejected since they diminished the head, which she now recognized as a feature common to all, a small pedestal bearing a disproportionate load, although proportions may not accurately represent her perception. Since it implies a comparative standard, I was convinced she did not yet possess. However, she came to the conclusion, I thought she showed good sense, and I took her comment about the relation of the two, headdress and head, as a promising sign of discrimination. People were not to her taste, but the sight of our dog, Prater, so-called since he made free use with so many of its trees, excited her affectionate approval. She found the dog far superior in form and grace to its owners. And later in the park, when she saw dogs being walked, she remarked on how surely the dogs led the scarecrows behind them, under the impression that the dogs took their masters for a walk and controlled their itinerary. Dogs indeed never failed to excite her affection, and she took to hugging and kissing those that visited us in the company of their owners, often finding the owner so lacking in beauty as to be repulsive to her. This I felt to be a passing eccentricity, for I could not entertain the idea of its persistence. Being ambitious for my patient, I naturally anticipated the full relief of her disabilities would lead to a happy marriage if, as the cynics doubt, such there be, though I have seen some. Her passion for dogs seemed a displacement of natural feelings for the opposite sex, an opinion not discouraged by her preference for male over female dogs. At times this caused embarrassment for my wife and myself when some dog, finding his advances reciprocated, mistook her in turns for a member of his own species, and mounting her extended footer limb, proceeded to pump on it with happy vigor, smiling, panting, and looking around for approval all the while. The poor girl, witless as to the dog's aim and mistaking his enthusiasm, would encourage him with little cries, meanwhile calling on others to witness this display of affection. The dog's owner would be confused between ignoring the scene and offering stern remonstrances to his dog, which the girl protested prettily. Her sight was still far from clear at her moments of greatest enjoyment. Her pupils would roll up, leaving only the whites, and the scene was odd enough to press itself on the attention of visitors who were trying to ignore both this phenomenon and the misbehavior of their dogs. Her affection for these animals was constantly on display when we took our walks outside. They seemed to know that here was someone vulnerable to their advances, for we often gathered a motley train of dogs, large and small, some trailing leashes. But more astonishing to herself were her meetings with herself in the mirrors of our darkened room. How many times did I watch her silently, seating myself in the darker shadows of that room. When I would remove the bandage from her eyes, she would flinch, then gradually accustom herself to the crepuscular twilight. If you have ever watched a swimmer dawdle underwater, or a newborn foal attempting to stand, or some such beginning, you will have an idea of the quality of her motion, which combines something from each of these models. She often looked at herself piece by piece, particularly her hands, which she held very close to her eyes, no more than 10 centimeters, a distance that would blind you or me. After studying them closely back and front, she would pass them down the front of her dress, over her bosom, and sometimes to her thighs, bending to stroke them, or rather the fabric covering them. She would also disengage a few strands of her hair and pull them forward to study in the same near way. She would then pick up, after a few passes at the object, a snuff box or the Meissen figurine, which I valued but let her have, and bring it to her face in that close scrutiny. On a whim, I placed some miniatures on the table beside her, and she studied their tiny details with that intense near gaze, then reported back on every detail, not by name, but by description as her language attempted to isolate its object. The hair was, in a recently acquired geography, on top of, but she could not find the word for head, so she touched her own hair and then pointed to the painting, which I withdrew rapidly, since she was about to poke it rather than stop short. She had similar difficulty in finding words to go with other components of the face, whether neck or ear or lip. For the word face, what the word face covered for the rest of us, lapsed as Maria Teresa's gaze into a concatenation of separate details. I now decided to dispense with the bandage altogether. I had left her sitting by the window, rocking gently back and forth, as was her habit, when a slight smile made its appearance whenever she sat by the window. My servant Hans came running into my room, shouting, as much as his good manners would allow, "Mademoiselle P., Mademoiselle P.," I rushed to the room where my wife had preceded me. I quickly displaced her to discover that Maria Therese was gazing at the darkening sky, rocking back and forth with great agitation, uttering groans more animal than human, very tragic in their tone. It was that day, time of day, when the light, having decided to fade, does so very quickly. She gazed at the sky with eyes so open that I could see white above and below her pupils. Confused and puzzled as to what accident had caused this relapse, I quickly stroked her, closed her eyes, which led to further wailing, then gently opened as I attempted to balance the fluids to remove her distress and make her sensible to my voice. Her first words were, "Blind, blind, blind." Now, the reason for that is, and the time is on our heels here, that she had not been exposed to night and day, so the coming of the darkness she thought was a coming and reinstation of her blindness. And how simple that answer was once you knew it. She had seen the night fall and in her innocence thought the light was fading, not from the world but from her own eyes. And I talked to her about that, the succession of light and darkness, the harmony of the spheres, even a blink, I told her, even that involuntary shudder of the lids is a darkness which freshens and gilds the sight. In the brightest light, we have these split seconds of darkness, which, like the half notes on the piano, have their own rhythms and quavers. I then spoke to her about how our five senses partake of all this balance, as the blood courses through our veins, stealing to its quiet appointments in our interior darkness, where our mind's eye can follow. I don't know how much she heard of this. When she spoke, I was quite startled. These are some of the things she actually said. Her face was turned towards the sky, a dim radiance illuminated it. I could not see her features, but her voice was of one seeing a vision, and indeed she was. "The stars," she said, "the stars." Above us in the darkened house opposite, the stars seemed very close. I identified the Great Bear and Orion's Belt and the Pleiades. None of this she heard. "The stars, the stars," she repeated in wonder and delight. Nothing she had seen since her darkness had so enthralled her. Her face in starlight glimmered like that of a ghost without features, so that I, who do not imagine things, felt a shiver. Several thoughts came to me. In her imperfect vision, the stars may have seemed close enough to reach out her hand and touch them, or they could be, to my fancy, inside her eyes. As I looked up with her and through her eyes, I had another great fancy, that the stars were pinholes in a great dark sheath, behind which was a blaze of eternal light. Turning back to watch her, I requested her not to be disturbed by my close scrutiny. Her pupils were not fixed or still, but moved across the firmament, as if these spheres were a harmony to which her whole being responded. In my imagination, I could see the globes of her eyes, the tiny reflections of the constellations. It was a moment that led to such fancies, and a moment to be remembered all my life. My reverie was interrupted by her voice, gentle and girlish again. "The stars are the most beautiful sight that I have seen since I could see." So gotta go.